You're listening to the Tribe Tech Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tribe Tech Podcast. I'm Fayaza Khan.
And I'm Robert Hillier. Coming up.
As we know, investors want to be given the assurance around certainty on things like power and energy. If that continues to be a bottleneck, then, you know, it drives away investment.
After the G7 in Cornwall, how can special guest South Africa work with Southwest businesses?
But we start with the news that the government's chief scientific advisor, Sir Patrick Vallance, has been made head of a new National Science and Technology Council. This will look for big bets in the areas of science and technology that the UK could pursue, quote, for strategic advantage.
The Prime Minister has urged the body to embrace setting bold visions, acting with speed and taking risks on big public investments in technology to reach net zero emissions, new medicines to cure cancer, and new ways of keeping the public safe.
Whatever that means, Vallance said his new role would help coordinate investment in cutting-edge research and put science and tech right at the heart of policy making.
You're listening to the Tribe Tech Podcast.
Now, we've had our say on this quite a few times. Mm-hmm. I don't really think this is worthwhile based purely on the evidence that no government is good at this kind of thing.
However, I do think that with the COVID pandemic and with the track and trace app and buying all the vaccines, I think the government has found that bureaucratic ways of working aren't agile enough to get things done. And so maybe this is their nod to finding new ways of working.
Well, the track and trace app doesn't work, of course. But anyway, let's get the view rather than hours of an actual expert. Simon Tutton is the regional manager at Deepbridge Capital in Bristol.
I'll admit that I'm a sceptic when it comes to this kind of thing, especially with the government in its current guise that Boris Johnson seems to like grand announcements and grand plans that sound very exciting, but either don't come to fruition or aren't delivered very well. I mean, always up for science and technology being as close to everyone's hearts in many ways as possible. And, you know, I think you can't doubt Sir Patrick Vallance's kind of expertise. I'm also sceptical of our history of industrial strategy and industrial policy and kind of picking winners or even picking sectors to be winners and benefit from government support. I think government support can be very slow. They might have billions in the pipeline, but actually if it takes them years and years and years to get that money allocated because they're being so risk averse, that doesn't help anyone particularly. And I think certainly linking it to the vaccine program, which yes, the vaccine was a great success. We invented one of them in Oxford, but that really wasn't the success of the vaccination program. The success of the vaccination program was buying loads of it and getting on with it, which I don't see as related particularly to a strategy of encouraging R&D and successful companies in this country. So, that's the kind of more negative end of it. On a more positive side, if what comes out of it is more funding for R&D and more fostering of innovation ecosystems, I think that could be healthy. But I think that's where more emphasis needs to be put in terms of looking at the Southwest and Bristol as a great example. I don't think the government or any particular strategy on a national basis has had an impact, but certainly you look at the two kind of really major things in the area of Set Squared as an accelerator program or an incubator, Future Space and the Robotics Lab. It's university driven primarily. And then people like Unit DX, that was a real entrepreneurial thing that is going to make much more of a difference, I think, than the government picking winners in whatever way. It'll be interesting to see what shape it takes ultimately.
So I'm a bit like you, Simon, because I'm also quite skeptical of government task forces and starting up all policy making groups, etc., and then, you know, nothing really happening, or them not understanding exactly what's needed. But I think what happened with COVID was the government realized that there was a benefit to working in the way startups work, and there's a benefit to science and technology informing policy. It's a bit late, but that's fine. But what I wonder is, how do you think it would be able to work? Yes, okay, you know, fostering technological ecosystems, et cetera, but what would be the practicalities of Sir Patrick Balance's task force? How would that work so that it actually makes a difference?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great question. It's something, since you raised the question, I've been trying to think about, ultimately. And it's where I slightly struggle. I mean, the government in general has some great things. Just like EIS as a scheme is a fantastic risk mitigator for investors. So that's great. And the, you know, there's extra funding coming in from the British Business Bank. You know, Deep Bridge has got a slug of that money to co-fund alongside our main funds. I mean, I'm thinking there's a danger as well in the, when we're picking our winners, that we're going to play to our strengths, which in one way I make sense, absolutely, but it completely jars with DeepBridge's approach of investing nationally, but also, you know, Boris Johnson's much fated levelling up agenda. Because if we're looking at science and technology, that, you know, naturally would focus very much on the Golden Triangle. I wonder how much will spill out, and thinking about, well, what actually makes a difference? Well, if they can find ways of fostering kind of an entrepreneurial culture at universities. So is that helping to fund the universities in a better way? I think universities have struggled with uncertainty of funding over the last few years, and they've been turned into their own entrepreneurial beasts, but that seems to have manifested itself into them becoming largely property companies, which has been damaging over the last 18 months as all the students haven't been there. But also things like infrastructure and actually making sure that universities have lots of lab space. You know, UnitDX was born out of the fact that Bristol has a complete dearth of lab space, and I'm sure that's replicated, you know, in other cities. Chester and places like that, where there's just not enough physical infrastructure to actually develop these companies. And then I don't know, how do you change a culture? How does the government really change a culture to make sure that people are ready and willing to set up businesses and keep on doing that? And it's that's more of a long-term vision, which I think has been changing it over the past 10 years in some quite radical ways, but I don't think that's driven by government. I think that's driven by awareness, by other people being aware and having the freedom to, the autonomy to operate in many ways and make decisions for themselves.
So looking at this through a Southwest lens then, just for a second, an unimpressive name drop for me when I was speaking to the president of the World Bank at the G7, mainly because no one else wanted to, because they were stuck on a bus. But I still did it. His advice, not that it was particularly groundbreaking, but he made it clear that what the Southwest needs to do more is to start to cluster, decide what it's for, to look at the Cambridge model and start to build out from universities and build your ecosystems around that. So taking from what you've said there and what the likely focus of this technology council is going to be, do you think the Southwest is correctly positioned across the piece to be able to cluster in this way, to explain what its focus is and to take advantage of what's happening within its university system?
Interesting question. I mean, there's probably people out there better placed to comment on that. I mean, there's some really obvious strengths in the Southwest, but it was interesting. There's an article that Bryony Phillips actually highlighted on LinkedIn, which was asking several people what are the strengths, and it was interesting to see how many different opinions there were about what is the strength of the Southwest, and where do you draw the line. I think there's various different clusters within the Southwest, so I don't know if you can have, you know, if you really said, oh, well, it's all about aerospace engineering, well, great for Bristol, but how does that do for Cheltenham as much, or Exeter, or the burgeoning kind of tech campuses there seems to be in Cornwall? I'm not sure about that. And so there's...
And also that doesn't seem to reflect on, certainly in terms of what was coming out of the big brokers at the G7, certainly didn't mention aerospace and engineering, and the government doesn't mention this in its focus either. So do we have to make sure that we pivot to them rather than trying to explain to people what it is that they think they should be interested in?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been I saw a criticism of this, science and technology, and it, nowhere does it mention engineering. And yet that is one of the Southwest's biggest features. And again, with looking at renewables and sustainability, there's very little mention of that. You know, it seems like a knee-jerk reaction to a pandemic where they've had a success that's science-based, and they want another big strap line and say, look, we're doing amazing things. And haven't actually thought about where do we need to be positioning ourselves for the future. What does our economy really look like? And there's a potential for there to be sectors that really lose out or have a missed opportunity, because, you know, renewables is another big focus for the Southwest, and I think it's a big focus for the future. But that seems to be completely absent from any announcement anyway. And it, you know, also jars with the fact that the government has largely pulled away. They don't subsidise the renewable energy sector anymore, yet they do subsidise North Sea oil and gas. And ultimately there's not many things don't fit to hang together with this. So yeah, I suppose I'm just a bit suspicious about it overall, ultimately. But in terms of Southwest, I think that we... Things like Tech Southwest is brilliant, but again, that's not from the government. That's from a group of people realizing that we need to cluster up and figure out what's going on and find our own voice and help us find our own voice within the ecosystem. I think your question earlier is, well, what can the government actually do? Well, that's a really interesting one, and maybe it's what we should be talking about more amongst ourselves and saying, well, actually, we need, rather than you saying this is what you need and imposing it upon us.
Where should universities be looking to promote investment? Like, where should we be going and what direction should we be taking, do you think, to ensure that we do have these clusters and we do have places for people to speak, and but we also use the universities as a base for doing this?
Because just to add on to that, some critical, I think the fact this came out so soon after the G7, I think this picked up on what that international direction of travel may well be, and obviously climate change and looking to invest in tackling climate change is such a clear focus in internationally. Do you think that if you're not in some way focusing on that you are going to miss out on some of the major investments?
Yes, I absolutely think that, you know, if we're not at the forefront, other people will steal a march on us. And we, I don't think that, so, you know, various governments have been particularly wise in how they've handled the sector, and, you know, continuing not to be wise. In terms of university, I think universities are slightly hamstrung themselves, and they need to be free to act. And I think you're right, Fayaza, in terms of you can't be one person. There needs to be a whole culture, and there needs to be a kind of groundswell. And I think this is coming. in terms of what universities need or need to be doing. I mean, Set Squared is the shining example, isn't it? And it shows actually that you're stronger together, and just trying to polish. I mean, Bristol University, to give them their credit, they work with those other four universities in Set Squared. They work pretty closely with UWE on, you know, around the Bristol Robotics Lab and things like that. And that seems to be where its collaboration seems to be where the good things are really born out of, because you don't have enough critical mass by yourself, whereas actually as a cluster of five or six universities, you really do. And so maybe it's really trying to replicate those kind of successes. I mean, obviously you don't want to just have exactly the same thing, because it might not be fit for purpose, but trying to see what they've done well and take those good things, and encouraging people really to work together in that kind of way, so that pooling their resources. And so I don't know what, you know, I'm not from a university background, so I don't know what the barriers to that are, or
Bristol. Ego, I think mainly.
Pardon?
I think the barriers are mainly ego.
Ego.
I do think that, you know, like, yes, you're absolutely right. Collaboration is key for universities, especially, you know, because a lot of people now don't want to go to university. They don't see the benefit in it. It's far too expensive when you could be doing an apprenticeship and earning money at the same time. Why would you go to university? So if universities collaborated more, they'd actually be able to save themselves. But what's stopping them is their ego. So yeah, how do you change that? You can't.
I think as well, having worked at university, they're just big clunky bureaucracies as well, like everything else, with slow decision-making structures and wary of sharing funding and sharing knowledge and sharing ideas. And I think it's like working in any other sort of semi-public sector organisation. They're not just often agile enough to see opportunities in a commercial enough way and take advantage. I don't know.
Yeah, 100%. And there's a slight academic culture problem as well, I believe, in that there's an awful lot of pressure on academics to publish. And they're not given enough space to ensure that their research is always of the highest quality. So they I think there's a pressure to go quantity over quality. And
that sounds like any research, isn't it? You're always looking for your next piece of funding. So the pressure is, I have to come up with a finding that's interesting, so it gets published. So at all costs, absolutely right. Which is wise, because if you actually look back at any big government funded project, for which you might even have to go back to the US space program, people have to get on with it, aren't they? They're not expected to do anything really in the meantime, because it means your focus, as you say, is then on making sure that people think you're doing something.
It's funny that you look at mentioning the US space program. If you think about it, like, the NASA itself doesn't appear to have stimulated a huge industry, like the kind of latest most progress into building a kind of space industry is all private sector, and largely down to, sadly, people with massive egos like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, who've really transformed the sector. And now NASA comes to SpaceX.
Simon Tutton there. I loved chatting to him. He was brilliant. I like that when people are a little bit more controversial, it's a better chat.
I don't agree. The Queen there, speaking to reporters at the Eden Project, being forced to enjoy herself ahead of a gourmet banquet in a biodome with Joe and Jill Biden. Hashtag boring evening out.
Did you have to pretend you were having a good time?
No, I did enjoy it. It allowed me to get highly irritated on expenses. As is so often the case, the local news agenda can get dominated by domestic disputes, in this occasion Northern Ireland sausages and made-up rows with Emmanuel Macron. But offstage, there was an attempt to start painting the picture of a new post-Brexit global Britain.
Right, and the G7 hosts did get to invite some non-G7 members, as they do every time. And it's interesting to see who they chose. I was very proud that they chose South Africa. So my president, Cyril Ramaphosa, flew into Cornwall. They also had India. But whatever my views on you know, the South African government. I loved that Mr. Ramaphosa was here. And let's find out what the rest of South Africa made of it, though. We are speaking to Sobuzwe Ngobese, who writes for Political in South Africa.
South Africa cracking the invite is a big deal, you know. So I would say among the people that follow the current affairs, this was a big deal. You know, the fact that South Africa had a seat on the table. And obviously the big issue for South Africa was the accessibility of vaccines. And President Ramaphosa sort of went to the G7 with that as a one of the top agenda items to influence, you know, the G7 on the issue of the intellectual property waiver. So it was a big deal, but I guess on the local news, the big story is the third wave of COVID that is upon us at the moment. Well, for the last 2 weeks, really.
So obviously the access to the vaccines was a question that was asked a lot, and the new Director General of the World Trade Organization, who herself is African, spoke a lot when she was there that the global economic recovery and the figures and the forecasts for the next 12 months are directly linked to access to the vaccine. But it didn't really seem to cut through with the leaders. I mean, there were calls, weren't there, for 11 billion vaccines to be provided. And in the end, the announcement was for 1 billion. Do you think, has this caused a bit of disappointment where you are, that they haven't quite delivered what it was maybe they said they were going to?
Yes, this would go down as a disappointment among the, you know, the African countries. Because as you know, we have massive amounts of people that are, you know, desperately waiting to be vaccinated. In South Africa specifically, the vaccine program, you know, has also not gone as fast as people expected. Just today, there were protests, you know, putting pressure on our, you know, the body that approves different types of vaccines to do so speedily, because we've only been doing the over 60s in terms of age. And on the 1st of July, we will have, you know, the people 50 and above. So we still far behind, and in terms of the vaccines, we have very low stock at the moment and a huge demand. So that announcement, it's better than nothing, but it would have been a disappointment for the African countries.
The South African government takes 6 to 9 months to produce one passport. How on earth are they going to vaccinate every single citizen in about less than a year?
Yeah, I think there's general skepticism that will happen. I'm naturally an optimist myself, but, you know, if the last few months is anything to go by, I think we're looking at mid-2022.
So, of course, one of the reasons that the South African president was invited was because the UK government is looking to expand its economy globally, look beyond the EU now and see what opportunities are out there. So that would have formed part of President Ramaphosa's invite. Which parts of the South African economy are they looking to expand, and are they looking for foreign investment? Where are those areas of opportunity? It's a bit of a longer curve over there, but as we do now start to think about life after COVID, where are some of the opportunities, do you think, within the South African economy?
The first thing to say is that one of South Africa's biggest problems is the high unemployment rate. And so President Ramaphosa's top priority in trying to get FDI into South Africa is to see those investments creating jobs. The whole pandemic situation has not helped our problem of high unemployment. So in terms of specific sectors where there are opportunities, you know, the UK obviously is South Africa's largest trading partner, and the manufacturing sector as well as the services sector are areas that I see opportunities for investment. We all want to see this economic recovery happening as fast as possible, and the issue of, you know, vaccination and not closing down the economy again. I mean, just this coming Sunday, the president is expected to possibly impose a harder lockdown on the Johannesburg or Gauteng province, where really the third wave is hitting hard. But there have been signals from the government that they will not do the hard lockdown that we saw early last year, because the impact on the economy was just too much to bear, really.
I think for South Africa, I believe that one of the areas that could be developed further is the tech sector. And the lockdown, all of the lockdowns, could be easier to bear for South African citizens if there was better access to the internet and better access to working remotely. And I know that isn't actually the case. So, for example, here in the UK, it was much easier for people. It was very difficult, obviously, during lockdowns, but it was still much easier than it was for South Africans who couldn't actually fully work remotely from home, because either, you know, because you have internet bandwidth that isn't very high, competition isn't great because, you know, you don't have unlimited internet, whoever you're buying internet from, unless it's extremely expensive. So it's not accessible to the average South African. And this includes phone data as well. So if the tech sector, specifically internet access to start with, was, you know, just revolutionized in South Africa, then things would be amazing for the citizens. So what's stopping the government doing that?
Yeah, I think you've touched on a very big topic for South Africa, the internet accessibility and, you know, access to technology, because really that is what will drive, you know, the South African economy. So coupled with that challenge is the issue of the electricity or access to, you know, we've had ongoing power outages. And now being the winter, that has not helped. So what we've seen from the government in the last 2 weeks was a strong move towards making the private sector play a bigger role in providing energy access. Because that was, in fact, and the government admitting its failures when it comes to power generation through Eskom, which is one of the biggest, state-owned entities. So what's happened now is that the government is inviting independent power producers to play a part in the economy. So we expect the government to do the same when it comes to the issue of spectrum, in as far as making internet accessibility much wider, and also from a cost point of view, make it more accessible. I mean, the data prices in South Africa, relatively speaking, are quite high, which doesn't help access.
I think a lot of people, me included, consider that most innovation, and particularly technological innovation, tends to be done really without governments getting involved, that they tend to be so slow, they're so far behind where the private sector are, that you can't either expect them or rely on them to do this. And that's certainly the case in the UK, where we've now just established a body which is going to be looking at where they can invest financially into emerging tech markets. Do you think in South Africa that it will be the same, that it will be reliant on individuals, entrepreneurs, forward-thinking companies to start moving and modernizing South Africa's economy because the government isn't really equipped to do it?
Without a doubt, the solution will definitely not come from the government. All they have to do is to create an enabling environment for those individual forward-thinking companies to drive progress in the sector.
Tweet now, Tech SW Official.
Pleased that you were standing throughout that interview in honour of your home nation. So do you think that for South Africans, the diaspora, like yourself and those over there, was coming to the G7, was it worthwhile for the country, do you think? Would it have passed most people by?
No, I think actually, like he said, it was an honour for South Africa to have attended the G7. There are so many countries in the world, yet South Africa was the one chosen and recognised. And currently, with the country in the turmoil that it's in right now with COVID and with the economy just flunking, it was probably a really, really good thing for South Africa to see that you haven't been abandoned, especially when so many people, including myself, have lost family members and loved ones this year due to the COVID pandemic. It's good to know that, you know, the rest of the world has recognized that and invited us to be part of a world stage event.
And it is still the case that there is money over there. There are areas of economic expansion. There are entrepreneurs seeking to grow their companies within the tech sector. And there are undoubted opportunities for Southwest companies if they know which space to look at, which, of course, was the reason that of all the countries that could have been invited, South Africa was one of them, because this government does see the South African economy as offering quite a few opportunities for startups working in the right sector. And the challenge will be to...
It's a blank slate.
It's a bit like the Wild West, isn't it, when you're over there. And the challenge is to marry and match up the opportunities on offer
but
with skills that are here.
It's very different to other African countries in the sense that there's infrastructure in South Africa that doesn't exist elsewhere. Because South Africa for such a long time had to survive on its own during apartheid because the rest of the world was boycotting the country, and rightly so. Obviously, I agree with that. But then what it meant was that South African businesses had to survive. So they just created their own stuff. So, oh, well, you don't want to sell us your biscuits? Fine, we'll just make an enormous bakery and sell the best biscuits in the world. Oh, so you don't want to send your chocolate over? Who cares? Same with sugar, same with so many things, because the country is very, very rich in resources.
And that explains your weird biscuits.
I love my biscuits. Don't talk about my biscuits.
That's a song, isn't it?
Well, thanks everyone for listening. We have really enjoyed the podcast this month. We would love you to get in touch with us. Please find us on LinkedIn. You can find me, Fayaz Khan. You can find Robert Hillier as well, but I mean, he'll never reply, so, you know, don't bother. Yeah. Also, please tweet at TechSWOfficial or find us on Instagram, on Facebook. You can find me personally as well at Fayaza K. We would love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening.
Southwest Tech Daily as well.
Oh, yes. Actually, everything that we talk about on the podcast, we usually write up for a Southwest Tech Daily article. So swtechdaily.co.uk is where you can find that. Robert Hillier, who doesn't really get involved in social media, does actually write a whole bunch of stuff on there, so look out for that. Right, thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, whatever you're doing. Bye.
A Tech Southwest podcast, Tribe Tech. You can get in touch with us by tweeting Tech SW Official.